I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at RAINnetwork.com.
Welcome to the RAIN Insights podcast from RAIN Network. In this podcast episode, David Lawrence, co-founder of RAIN, speaks with Byron Tao about his new book, Means of Control: How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. Byron Tao is an investigative reporter and author. He currently works at a nonprofit outlet in Washington, D.C. called Notice, where he covers law, courts, and national security. Previously, he was with The Wall Street Journal and Politico.
Byron, first and foremost, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and congratulations on your book. I'm looking forward, as I know the audience is, to conversation. So thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
As a starting point, I think it would be of great interest to the audience, just sort of the motivation for writing the book, how you began the process, and obviously it involved painstaking research and obviously investigative journalism. And one of the reasons why I think this book is going to be very, very important to the social dialogue, but maybe you can take us into the beginnings of how this started.
Sure. So sometime back in 2018 or so, I got a tip over a dinner. All reporters love a good tip. And what this person basically explained to me was that the Department of Defense, through some contractors and through some research efforts, was starting to buy up large amounts of mobile advertising data to do tracking. Essentially, this was data that was coming off of things like mobile apps or ad networks and showcased the location of hundreds of millions of phones and their movement records and patterns. And this was pretty extraordinary to me. You know, I thought I was pretty tech savvy. I thought I knew a lot about how governments surveilled people, and I thought I knew about warrants and lawful intercept and the FISA laws. But this vector of purchasing just as a commercial buyer, large amounts of data on the global population, and as I would find out, including on American citizens in some instances, was something I really hadn't considered. And, I thought it was a pretty fascinating and important story. I thought it had a lot of civil liberties and privacy implications. And so I started digging into it, and it was slow going at first. It took understanding a lot of different things like intelligence law and also marketing and national security and, a lot about how the Justice Department and others had construed their legal authorities and the Fourth Amendment and the third party doctrine. But eventually I was able to piece together the fact that this was a pretty robust phenomenon. It had been going on for 20 or so years. And given the amount of data that was increasingly available for sale and how detailed the data was becoming, it was a growing phenomenon.
What actually surprised you, Byron? Was it the fact that the data was available for purchase or that the government was purchasing it?
I think it was a little bit of both. When I started doing this reporting, I was not aware just how much data was out there and available for sale from data brokers, and it hadn't really crossed my mind, and I don't think it crossed the minds of a lot of ordinary Americans or even people in civil society who sort of study these things, that the commercial markets out there for data were also ripe for government interest. And of course, in hindsight, it makes a ton of sense, right? Because governments, like all organizations, are looking to understand the world and do their missions a little bit better and a little bit easier. And with the amount of data that's out there and in many cases available for sale from data brokers of all kinds, it certainly makes sense. But when I had started this journey into trying to understand this, I don't think I either understood just how much data was collected by America's corporations and made available for sale, and just how interested governments were in acquiring it.
Well, apropos the government interest, if I remember the beginning of your book, I think either the first chapter or second chapter is set around the 9/11 attacks. And I think you use the phrase coming out of, quite frankly, the 9/11 Commission report that there was a failure to connect the dots. I think the opening line is it was a failure, not so much of intelligence, but of imagination, and hence the connect the dots. And I assume you began that first chapter for a reason, maybe it was the second chapter, around the events of 9/11. Maybe you can set the stage for why the beginning of the book started there.
Yeah, I think 9/11 in many ways represented a sort of different kind of mission for the United States government and its military and its intelligence community. Before 9/11, the posture of the United States was built around understanding the intent of a foreign nation or foreign nations, primarily the Soviet Union and its allies. But into the 90s, the nation states and were still basically the basic unit of the international system and what the U.S. intelligence apparatus was geared around. But after 9/11, suddenly the mission changed a lot. Suddenly the U.S. had to start tracking small networks of people that were embedded in a larger population and had to potentially try to separate, law-abiding normal people, both in the United States and abroad, from people who intended to do harm to the U.S. or her allies. And so that was a whole different kind of mission, and it took a different set of tools. And so after 9/11, the FBI put together this pretty interesting and detailed chronology of the 9/11 attacks, told primarily through the lens of sort of transactions, like discrete events. And in many instances, these were transactions that came out of corporate data. So you're talking about hotel records and rental car records and where a certain hijacker went to the gym and where they rented an apartment. So the story of the run-up to the attack in many ways relied on corporate data. And increasingly, government agencies and government researchers and outside data brokers became aware that the data that was in the hands of corporate America could tell just as rich, if not a richer story, than the government's classified intelligence. And that if all that data could be weaved together in sort of big picture computer systems or projects, that potentially the next attack could be thwarted. And had that system been in place during 9/11, perhaps those events could have been avoided. And so there became a tremendous amount of interest in what was back then called data mining, basically going through large volumes of data, some of it corporate data, some of it from data brokers, and some of it classified data, and looking for things like patterns or outliers or strange templates of behavior. And there were a variety of programs that government entities stood up around this. Total Information Awareness was one of them, but there were also some others. There was one run by the FBI that was aiming at tracking down people who had gotten visas or were in the United States and could potentially have ties to foreign terrorist organizations. And then, of course, the military's counterterrorism mission overseas was also taking advantage in some ways of this kind of data. So I think 9/11 was important for those reasons, that it really refocused the priorities of the intelligence community and the military and our public safety entities on a different kind of mission, and one that corporate data, data that was available for sale, that was in the hands of airlines and banks and data brokers, that they might have something to offer the war on terror.
So I find it fascinating that you began your book there, in large part because when people look back on 9/11, I think they tend to think about, the tragic events of that day and the repercussions. But a lot changed as a result, and I think your book highlights that. And obviously, the whole method of traveling by air has changed. The way we navigate airports, the way we get passports, the industry around, various travel passes, Byron, who gets in what line and how they get reviewed and inspected. But something else changed as well. I mean, the whole data broker, as you point out, the whole data brokerage industry has evolved since those days. I think you cite to Axiom, the database that was, I think, located in Arkansas that, you know, had a lot of valuable information in it. Maybe you can talk about what has evolved over time in terms of the data that is available to be purchased, what is being purchased, what's being monetized, just within the private sector, and then we'll go into sort of the relationship between the data brokers and government agencies.
Sure. So, yeah, the heart of the story I tell in the book is, you know, a type of company that most Americans don't really give much thought to, and that's the data broker. You know, the book's not really focused around the big tech companies like Google and Meta and Apple. And data brokers came out of the 1960s. They were originally born to try to do sort of mass mailings and consumer targeting and to help banks, you know, target their mailers to consumers. And they were collecting sort of stuff you would find in the phone book. You know, address history, names of people. Sometimes they'd get stuff that was down at the public courthouse, like marriage records and licenses and other stuff like that, property records, deeds. And they would do some basic demographics on it. So maybe they could marry that data set with the census records and make guesses about your income or your race. And then they started to vacuum up things like consumer records from stuff like magazine subscription lists. So what could we tell about you as a consumer if you subscribe to Rolling Stone versus if you subscribe to Golf Digest? And how could we best market to you given the information we had? So that was the early generation of data brokers, and that was represented by companies like Axiom, like Sizent, ChoicePoint. There's a number of these, LexisNexis. And, you know, after 9/11, that was the initial generation of data brokers that were first drawn into sort of government experiments in how commercial data might be useful in counterterrorism or public safety. But as things changed, as social norms changed, and as technology changed, there was an evolution in the data brokerage industry. So the first sort of turn I focus on is on the rise of data brokers that specialized in obtaining social media data sets. So when Facebook and MySpace and Instagram and Twitter all came onto the scene, and people all around the world started using them to communicate, to post pictures, to argue with one another, there increasingly became a market for first corporations to try to understand what was being said on social media. And that made some sense, right? If you were a big brand, you wanted to see what people were saying about you. You wanted to see if, you know, you were trending either for a good reason or a bad one. But of course, governments got interested in that as well, because we saw terrorist groups like ISIS take real advantage of open social networks like Twitter and others. And then, you know, then another turn happens as mobile phones really start dominating the consumer tech world. So, you know, beginning in 2007, 2008, with the introduction of the early iPhones and eventually Android, increasingly data brokers sprung up to try to understand where mobile phones were going and who they belonged to and what people were putting on them. Again, largely for commercial purposes, to target ads at them and to understand what people liked as consumers and what kind of software they were interested in, what their hobbies were, and how best to serve them targeted ads based on all that data. But of course, there's government interest in that sort of data as well. And then the final sort of technological change I report on in data brokers is the rise of sort of what I call gray data, which is a reference to gray literature, which is a kind of open source intelligence that's stuff not published through traditional publishing channels, but is unclassified. So think sales brochures or academic research reports or think tank reports. That's all gray literature. And there's increasingly a category of data just like that. So all the wireless signals that we all give out all the time, time, the Wi-Fi base station in our home, you know, all these Bluetooth devices that we carry around. Even our car tires have little sensors in them that broadcast something about the car tire pressure. All these are radio signals, and if you know how to listen and you know where to look and you have the right technology, you can vacuum them up, and in many cases, you can sell them and broker them. And there were companies that moved into that space, in part for the commercial market, right? Some of these companies had some research where they said, you know, what if I could go out and tell you how many Fitbits there were in the world versus how many Apple Watches, and I could give you investment information based on that. But of course, this is a fairly interesting cyber capability, and of course, governments were there as well, taking advantage of that kind of data and figuring out what they could figure out with it. So those are sort of the four generations of data brokers that I talk about in the book. And, you know, some of them are giant household names or semi-household names like Thomson Reuters or LexisNexis. And some of them are deeply obscure and have only a few employees and are based in the DC, the DC suburbs. But, you know, that's the market that I found in looking into this.
And you also found what I'll refer as an overarching lack of controls or regulation around these companies in terms of what they were able to purchase and how the data got used and resold, et cetera. Maybe you could take a moment or two to talk about that.
Yeah, so by and large, you know, Congress has largely let this industry emerge without a tremendous amount of regulation. You know, Congress is perfectly capable of legislating on privacy and putting statutory barriers in the way of government or other corporations from accessing data. And we've done that with things like healthcare. We've done that with, you know, things like video rental history when a nosy reporter went to try to dig up Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork's video rental history. But with the rise of the internet in the 1990s as a consumer technology, Congress, I think, didn't want to stifle innovation and worried about, you know, strangling this new network in its cradle. And so it largely left the internet alone in terms of regulation. And, you know, again, after 9/11, I think there was a separate impetus to, you know, not try to interfere too much in information sharing and public-private partnerships. And so essentially, the scenario that we have today in the United States, at least, is a fairly lightly regulated industry in terms of how companies can collect data and what they must tell consumers about what they're doing with it. And by and large, a lot of these companies have, you know, determined that as long as they put something in the end user license agreement or the terms of service or the privacy policy, and often that something is quite vague, like, you know, we may collect anonymized information and use it for analytics and share it with our third-party partners, that generally speaking covers a whole spectrum of behavior from brokering data to selling it directly to intelligence entities or military commands or law enforcement. And so by and large, you know, the number of times people have described the sort of data collection world to me as the Wild West is staggering. I think I did a control F search through my notes for that phrase the other day, and it came up probably 10 or 15 times from people who were in industry or in government. And that's essentially what we have, that, you know, yes, some states have tried to put some privacy laws in place. Yes, Europe has passed a comprehensive privacy law that they hope will protect their citizens. But in general, this is an extremely loosely regulated space, and one, you know, I think there is increasing attention on it, but it's still, you know, there's still a long way to go to bring it under control and to put some regulations in place that would stop a lot of what I describe in the book.
So Byron, I want to sort of unpack what you just said, because it has been a popular message that nobody wanted to stifle the growth of the internet. But the fact of the matter is that when it comes to the data, and I'm glad you touched upon this, you know, the so-called privacy policies, usage policies, I've been a lawyer for well over 30 years. I think I'm reasonably intelligent. I've tried reading those policies. I've printed them out. They're 40, 50 pages at times. And they very often get attached to services that Americans feel are indispensable in their lives, whether it's, you know, access to certain search engines, or, you know, even simple things like, not picking on Apple, but, you know, the use of one's cell phone, or even the iTunes library, the music we download, the apps we load on. And maybe you could share with us sort of your perspective and what your research found about what I'll refer to as, you know, there is a check the box around privacy policies. You accept, you don't accept. There's an updated privacy policy. You accept, you don't have access. But just in terms of what I'll refer to as the contract that consumers have signed or been forced to sign. In the law, there's something called the contracts of adhesion. But how you think about that bargain that has been struck along the way since the very beginning of time, in terms of what people are consenting to, what they actually know they're consenting to, and the descriptions of how their data is being used.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, first of all, no normal person reads them. You may read them, and some other lawyers may read them, and I, as an interested journalist, read them. But by and large, most people have been trained to just click "I accept." But even if you were to read them, you know, they make a number of claims that do not hold up on its face. And I'm particularly talking about the kind of brokers that have large amounts of geolocation data and other sort of invasive data sets. But in many instances, these vendors are telling consumers two things. One, that they're collecting the data for commercial purposes or analytics. And two, that if it is shared with a third party or sold, that it's what they call anonymized, so that there's no personally identifiable information transmitted to other parties. And you know, both of these things are not accurate. On the anonymization piece, you know, I'm the only person who wakes up at my residential address and rides my bike down the mall here in Washington, D.C., and goes to an office in Georgetown. And even if there's no personally identifiable information attached to my data, that you could, with a fair amount of a fairly easy bit of tradecraft, figure out who I am in a data set of showing everyone in Washington, D.C.'s phone moving around. On the commercial piece, there's just no way for these companies to say for sure who will and will not get the data after they sell it. Yes, it's a commercial market. Yes, a lot of hedge funds and real estate analytics players and mobile advertisers, a lot of them use this data, but there's no way to ensure that foreign governments, the U.S. government, private investigators, journalists, think tanks, they can all buy this data. And there's really no way for a company to be sure what happens after they sell their data to another entity. Yeah, they can put contractual provisions in place, and many of them do. I have found in reporting on this world that many of those contractual provisions are ignored or twisted in ways that the original company sharing the data might not fully understand. And so I don't believe that these end user license agreements or privacy policies or terms of service are really providing meaningful consent to the people who download the software. And even if they were to read them, I think they would get an incomplete and misleading understanding of exactly what they're sharing and who is getting it.
And a point that's certainly implicit in your book is that even if people could understand what they're giving up, is there a choice here? Because,
yeah.
And that's, I thought that was a fundamental point that was, you know, brought out by your book.
Right, because in many instances, these are services that we have become increasingly reliant on, right? I mean, it's true that we did have civilization before there were mobile phones, before there were search engines, before there was social media. But, I mean, increasingly, people do believe that, you know, the search engine, the maps function on their phone, the social media, that these are the necessities of life in the 21st century. And to do without them would cripple them and probably the whole U.S. economy in ways that would be unhealthy. And so we are deeply reliant on mobile phones and computer systems for everything we do. And, you know, a lot of these services leech data or generate data or, you know, cause data to be sold about us in ways that I don't think we fully understand and don't think we have been fully told by these giant entities that control so much of our lives.
And I thought that that was a very fundamental thesis. I know a lot of the focus, and I've heard some of your interviews already, has been about the alliance between the data brokers and the government. We'll get into that in a moment. But there seemed to be almost a foundational point, Byron, that around consumer protections, consumer rights, what are we giving up? Do we know what we're giving up? Did we have a choice in what we're giving up in the modern society? And I know you've focused, it's a lightly regulated or it's a Wild West or what have you. I have a slightly different view. I don't think it may operate as the Wild West, but I actually think that there have been a variety of parties who have come together who say this is, you know, this lack of regulations actually is a marketplace that is beneficial to a number of players, but that the consumers have been left out in terms of what they know, what they're giving up, what they've consented to give up. And obviously, you know, the notion of your data being monetized by other people. I think there's a popular expression a number of years ago that if the product is free, you are the product. And I thought that that was a important point that your book was making about what people actually don't understand about the data brokerage industry, and privacy policies.
I think that's right. And I also think that if you give consumers real meaningful choice, they do tend to opt out. So I'm thinking of Apple in particular in the last few years has made a lot of changes to its operating system. And, you know, in the old days of mobile apps, when the iPhone first launched, you know, 10 or so years ago, or 15 at this point, it was fairly easy for developers to start collecting a lot of location data in the background from people who forgot that they clicked I accept when, you know, some mobile game they downloaded asked for permission to track them 24/7. But sometime a few years ago, Apple started really pushing this change to users, saying, hey, did you know your weather app collected, 1,200 location points on you in the past 48 hours? Are you sure you want to continue to share that? And you can actually downgrade the settings and only allow it to track you when you open it. Would you like to do that? And by and large, many consumers chose that option.
Right.
Similarly, Apple made it much easier to stop what they call cross-app tracking, which is essentially developers, giving you a mobile, quote-unquote anonymized mobile ad ID and seeing, you know, what you do on different apps and different websites. When Apple presented consumers with this option, would you like to allow apps permission to track you across your across other apps in the web? Lots and lots of people opted out of that. So when consumers are truly presented with meaningful ability to opt out of some of this data collection, a lot of them take it. The problem is many of them are very cynical. Many of them are, don't really believe they can reclaim any of their privacy, and or maybe they don't fully understand the trade-offs. And so they feel hopeless and they just click accept because that's what they've been trained to do. But, when tech companies take steps to give people true and meaningful consent, it seems like many people don't consent.
Also, not to digress too much, but the right to privacy was guaranteed in the Constitution. And if we had, at the beginning of time, I think it was Franklin who established the first postal system, but if, and there was a lot of concern that the Brits were intercepting mail and reading it, but if our first system of mail delivery was based upon people having access to the content and who we were writing to and getting answers back from, or first time we set up a telephone system, or first time we set up newspapers, you know, access to what we were reading and maybe how long we were, what we were reading within the newspapers on a daily basis or listening to on television, radio, or online, I'm not sure that that those methods of communication would have, you know, been able to be established. And they are, you know, the bedrock of our society. And I think of you as a journalist, and I know journalists have specific concerns about how they're tracked with their devices. They have to rely on, you know, electronic devices to do their work and such. I'm old enough also to remember the first time the FBI tried to subpoena a particular library chapter for the books that were taken out by certain people. And that became a significant ACLU First Amendment case. But I think we're, what I took away from your book was we're well past those points of consent and waiver and, quite frankly, arguments around privacy.
Yeah, and I think historically, you know, there have been, technology has often upended our notion of privacy or the limits of government or the Fourth Amendment. But in previous time periods, you know, Congress has been able to act. I think there was a debate early on about the telegraph or the telephone and whether you could wiretap it within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, Congress extends statutory protection to that, and it extended statutory protection to things like email. But today, you know, we generate so much information, and so much of it is in the hands of companies, third parties, in the parlance of the government and the courts. And the window that these third parties have on our lives today is extraordinary, and it's far beyond what was true 50 years ago. You know, then we kept important papers in our desk drawer. We, by and large, were not sharing all that much information with corporations. But today, to do anything, to visit the doctor's office, to hail a cab or an Uber, to order anything on the internet, to do basic research, we entrust tremendous numbers of third parties with our very sensitive and in some cases quite revealing information. And the reality is the law has not caught up to that reality. And some segment of that information is simply available for sale in these markets, and governments have realized it and are acting accordingly.
And just apropos your last point here, Supreme Court still ruling on whether law enforcement can attach a device to a car to track its whereabouts, whether that constitutes an unreasonable search. But law enforcement doesn't have to do that anymore, as you point out, between GPS data and tire data and Easy Pass data, et cetera. These cases, you know, as you say, the law has not quite caught up to where we are. There's been disruption in traditional concerns about the rights of privacy and the rights of unreasonable searches and seizures and warrants, et cetera. Let me ask you, I'm going to dissect the title of your book, which is wonderful, by the way, Byron. But if you were to explain to the average American what the portfolio of data on them would look like, and I recognize the deconstruction of anonymized data is something very often easy to do, but what would you tell the average American is available about them and their history and their whereabouts and their buying patterns and et cetera? What would the portfolio look like?
Well, I'd say that pretty much everything they do is in some data bank somewhere at this point, right? I mean, we all now do everything on our mobile devices and our computers. We communicate with one another. We make plans. We put our calendars in there. We make appointments with doctors. We have telehealth visits. We do all of our work. We store all of our documents. So pretty much everything you do is digitized somewhere. Now, it's not all available for sale. That's the good part. Some of it is protected by law. So medical records and your stored and sent emails, there are certain statutory protections for a lot of that stuff. Some companies have lots of data on you. Like, you know, think about your Facebook Messenger account or your Twitter direct messages that they don't sell, but they have it. You know, certain companies have things like DNA information that people have voluntarily given. But even if you haven't, if your second cousin did it, well, then a significant portion of your genome is in some data bank somewhere. And of course, then your location, things, the way you move around the world. So your phone pings the carrier's towers constantly. Your mobile apps are tracking your GPS if you've given them permission. Your car has telematic services today that go to who knows what third parties. Your car's license plate is often tracked on public roadways by either private entities in some cases or public ones. Often you're tracked on private property now with your license plate, right? Every time I've gone into a parking garage in DC in recent weeks, they now say they scan my plate, and that's how they're charging me. So there's just a tremendous amount of information on all of us that's available in some data bank somewhere. In terms of the data that's available straight up for sale, it's more limited, but it's still a pretty invasive picture of us. We're talking about address history and often our relatives and our property ownership and any licenses we've had and, you know, our voting registration. All that is public information that data brokers have. If you've ever said anything in a public or semi-public social media site like Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, that is available for sale in bulk by data brokers that scrape those sites. If you've been kind of careless with your location settings on your devices and allow a lot of apps to track your location, well, a pretty precise picture of your movement records is probably available. Tons and tons of consumer information about your sort of what sort of products you've Googled or what websites you frequent or what apps you download. All of that is in the mobile ad ecosystem and is probably tieable to you in some way, either by name or by your IP address or by the quote-unquote anonymized mobile identifier that Google's given you. And even weird stuff like your wireless base station is in some data bank somewhere. And you may not know this, but when people run in front of your house or drive down your street, you know, mobile phones are using your wireless network as a wayfinding device to help, you know, in combination with GPS, figure out where the phone is. And so all of this data is out there. And in many cases, it's available for purchase if you know where to look. And, you know, that is a tremendous amount of information about you that parties that you have never heard of have access to and are sometimes selling.
And as you point out, obviously conclusions are reached coming from that data about you, sometimes for just marketing purposes, sometimes for law enforcement purposes.
That's right. These companies can, you know, infer a ton about you based on stuff like what apps you put on your phone, what products you've Googled recently, where you go in the world, what you're interested in. All that can be used for corporate purposes and then has a secondary purpose where if you become someone of interest to a powerful government agency and doesn't even necessarily have to be our government, it could be a foreign government. If you're a dissident or you have family that lives in an oppressive country that's engaged in transnational repression, you certainly could be targeted, or at least a lot of information could be inferred about you from the rich set of corporate data that's out there and available for sale.
And I note, of course, your industry, investigative journalism, is particularly concerned about, you know, the tracking and whom you meet with, what you're working on, where you may be going, et cetera. Not just here in the States, but obviously the threat to journalists around the world is very, very acute.
Yep, and there's even an anecdote in my book where someone, a government contractor, told me they were approached by a person close to the Trump White House during the Trump administration and asked to try to track a certain reporter who had been writing stories not about classified information or any sort of, nothing that shouldn't be legally disclosed, but was merely politically embarrassing to the president. This person ran, had access to large amounts of movement data from phones, and they were asked by this official if they could maybe do an analysis to see who this reporter was meeting with and if they could potentially see if they could identify the source that gave them some piece of embarrassing information. This person refused to do that, but it's certainly a possibility, and it's something we've seen over and over again, both in the national security context, where every once in a while the Justice Department does something like subpoena the records of a reporter or try to get a search warrant for their email to try to figure out who their sources are. It's even escalated to the point of putting reporters in jail. But beneath the level of that, we've seen corporations try to harass journalists with private investigators. And again, this data is available to private investigators too, not just governments. And again, it's available to foreign governments who are routinely surveilling civil society and journalists. Journalists have been among the top targets of spyware like Pegasus and other vendors who sell these capabilities to governments. Journalists are frequently targeted with that sort of thing. Are high-profile people who are trying to, inform the public, but also piss off powerful forces in society, either governments or individuals, and are frequently need to be concerned about security and privacy and safety.
And Byron, I want to, in the last, 10 minutes or so that we have, I'd actually like you to deconstruct your choice of titles for the book, Means of Control, How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. How did you come to that title? And obviously there's a message in it about your concerns.
Boy, I was hoping no one would ask me this, because it came from a quote from Thomas Pynchon, and I was then forced to read Gravity's Rainbow, which is probably the single most difficult.
Oh my God!
Okay. book that I've ever had to force myself to read. But the quote is something along the lines of, "Once the technical means of control have reached a certain size, a certain degree of being connected to one another, the chances for freedom are over for good." And at one point in my book research, I had hired an excellent researcher who, was digging through court records and stuff for me, helping me with my research. And, he and I had lunch, and he basically said, I like this topic. There's this line from Pynchon that's been going through my head for 20 years, and I even have it pasted up above my desk. And here it is. It's a great line. You should use it as the epigraph. And, I loved it as well, because, I thought it implied that to have freedom requires a certain degree of space in civil society. And once, these overlapping systems of power become too powerful and too interconnected, that does threaten liberty. I don't want to suggest that, America's on the precipice of becoming some sort of totalitarian state, but the patterns are there, right? There is a lot of data collection. It's being done relatively carelessly, and not a lot of thought, at least until recently, has gone into what a threat large-scale data sets pose to citizens, and how it tilts the power away from individuals and towards powerful actors like corporations and the state. And in particular, when corporations and the state combine that power, I think citizens have more reason to be alarmed. It doesn't mean there aren't good uses for data, or that governments are always being inappropriate when they're accessing data sets. But in almost everything I write about here, we're talking not about targeted, individualized acquisition of data on a specific person or group that we believe has engaged in a crime or is a target of for foreign intelligence, but is in fact bulk collection. And I do think historically democracies have bulked at large-scale bulk surveillance programs, and the acquisition of huge amounts of data on the global population is yet another example of a bulk data program. And I think we should all apply a lot of skepticism and scrutiny to bulk data collection programs, including when they're done with corporate data. And so that's essentially the big idea that I was trying to convey with that title. And it took reading 700 pages of Gravity's Rainbow to make sure that I wasn't misquoting it. And I do not believe I am, but if anyone's a Pynchon scholar and wants to send me an email and tell me I got it all wrong, I'd love to hear from you.
I was going to say, talk about a labor of research in writing the book, if you read those 700 pages in order to get to the title. Sort of build on that a little bit. And one of the things that I and other lawyers in the bar, particularly in the defense side, have noted, the ability, I keep going back to the Constitution and, you know, rights of privacy and to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. And, you know, we've now created this great exception to that in terms of our devices and what we sign off on, so-called consensually, you know, in terms of our privacy and such. But the right to a trial and the right to due process has become extraordinarily expensive and onerous, almost oppressively so. And it certainly requires a great deal of time and a great deal of money and resources. In large part because the massive amounts of data that get thrown into a particular case. And the government obviously has pretty much infinite resources. They, in preparing, I was a prosecutor for 10 years, so I'm speaking a little bit from experience here, but they do have virtually an unlimited budget. But some U.S. attorneys have talked about the fact that this massive amount of data has gotten in the way of due process, whether working on the side of the government or working on the side of the defense. And I would just be curious to get your thoughts about this. And interestingly, as you probably, because you work with the Wall Street Journal, but you know, government agencies are requiring various regulated companies, public companies, companies in the financial sector, that they must retain all data. In fact, in the financial industry, a number of companies were fined very significant. There have been billions and billions of dollars in fines because their employees were speaking off networks where their messages and their communications were not being captured. And I'm just curious whether you've thought about this as well as the, sort of, let's call it, intended or unintended consequence of we'll call it the data industrial complex and sort of where we've gone since 9/11.
I didn't encounter the large volumes of data issue except in the context of, and this didn't quite make my book, but it was something I covered a lot at the Wall Street Journal. It was the January 6th trials and the investigation right around who breached the Capitol. There was obviously staggering amounts of data involved in that, but the FBI had tremendous difficulty processing it all to the point where it's actually today relying a lot on the efforts of sort of freelance, self-described sedition hunters who have actually done a fairly good job of unmasking and identifying some of these people based on some very clever detective work. But I will say that one of the phenomena I did find in this book was it's a little bit different, but it does go right to these questions about due process and trial fairness. And that's that in some of the instances where the data that was available for purchase was showing up in criminal trials, I found that the government and the vendors had sort of colluded to make it impossible for the defendant to realize that the government had been tracking them through a commercial data program. So there was a cartel-linked, or I believe it was a cartel-linked effort to dig a U.S.-Mexico border tunnel in a city in Arizona, and the tunnel went from a KFC on the U.S. side to a couple of houses on the Mexican side of the border. It wasn't a very far tunnel, but you know, basically, these drug smugglers had dug this tunnel, and the government was able to see using commercial cell phone data that there were devices crossing in a place where there's no port of entry. And so, what they did was they actually put the restaurant's owner under some surveillance for some period of time, and you know, at some point they saw he was at the restaurant, put a bunch of stuff in the back of his truck, drove away from the restaurant, and so then they pulled him over for a broken taillight, and then they called in a drug sniffing dog, and sure enough, they identified narcotics in the back of his truck. But in nowhere in the court filings or in speaking to the lawyer for this person did they ever mention that what they had done was essentially look for devices moving where they shouldn't be and identified this person. So they did a bit of parallel construction in order to conceal this very clever commercial data technique and never disclosed it in court. And I found that was a pattern sort of over and over again, that actually some of the vendors even put in their contracts that the government was never to refer to the data in a court filing or ever put the company on the stand because they couldn't necessarily vouch for the data. They were just buying it from other aggregators, and they didn't necessarily want the capability known. And I think that is also somewhat dangerous, right? Because, you know, in general, I mean, sometimes we let the names of informants and others not be introduced into the court record. But in general, we expect that we disclose investigative steps to the defendant and give them a chance to challenge the constitutionality of some of these tools and procedures. And in many of these instances, these vendors and the government entities that were working with them were denying defendants that opportunity. And so, you know, I do think these sometimes these programs can actually pose some real due process issues, especially when you write provisions like that into a vendor contract that, you know, never shall this data ever be referred to in court. It's, you know, it's for your eyes only. It's a tipping and queuing system, and we don't want it publicly known.
So just in closing, I'd like to take you back to a Senate hearing a number of years ago when Mr. Zuckerberg was called before the Senate, and Orrin Hatch asked him the question, I don't understand, Mr. Zuckerberg. People join Facebook for free. How do you make money? And the answer was, you know, pause for a second. Why? By advertising, Senator, by advertising. And I thought that answer was interesting because, and Senator Hatch went on, because advertising is viewed as that's their model, but what your book revealed was it is about the data. It is about the data collection, aggregation, organization, curation, monetization, and distribution. And one of the questions I had from your book is, I don't know how many people in the Senate or Congress may have read the book, but if someone were to basically produce the portfolio of data on every senator and every congressman and to show them this is what is out there about you. Yes, it was anonymized, but we were able to, you know, basically reconstruct, re-engineer. And just thought you should know. What do you think the reaction would be, Byron?
Well, there are. I think the reaction would be for Congress to exempt themselves from data broker data collection and potentially leave the rest of us at their mercy.
Okay. But
because I believe that's literally a proposal that's been kicking around Capitol Hill, is to extend special status to certain government officials, including members of Congress, to allow them to opt out of this kind of collection. But the rest of us will have to just suffer. But yeah, I think they would be alarmed at the amount of information that's collected about them, but whether they could overcome the inertia of the general sclerosis of our legislature to do something about it, I think that's a very open question.
Okay. So we're up against the time. I'd like to put you on the spot and ask for a second conversation, because I would love to hear your go through your suggestions on how the market can be fixed and what are some appropriate limits around data and the sale and the use by the government. Obviously, we started with 9/11. I don't think anyone would disagree that the ability to prevent another 9/11 is, you know, a very, very important function. There's an expression within the government about the bad guys only have to be right once. We have to be right every time. And, you know, fortunately, we've avoided, you know, a repetition thus far. We're doing this podcast literally 24 hours or so after the terrible attacks in Moscow, and there have been others, you know, around the world since 9/11. But I would love to continue the conversation with you, Byron. And I'd also like to end on the note that I felt your book was a tremendous public service. I know you're in the private sector. I know you're a journalist, but truly, I thought it was a terrific exercise in public service, and hopefully, you know, not only average Americans will read it, but I think it's a very important book for our policymakers as well.
Well, thank you so much. I'd be happy to come back.
That'd be great, Byron. And again, thanks so much for the time and the great book.
Thanks for having me.
This is the RAIN Insights podcast, which is part of the RAIN Insights series, comprised of both virtual and real-world events, offering unique practical perspectives from RAIN's leading experts in risk management. To learn more, please visit us at rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. Thanks for listening.